Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Dan Avern. And Dan, it's a crazy time in the sport of lacrosse right now. NLI signing period opened on Wednesday. The NLL and players, the Pro Lacrosse Players Association, are engaged in an ongoing labor dispute. We learned on Thursday afternoon that the NLL has canceled its first two weekends of games, December 1st and December 8th, which means that seven games are either going to be sacrificed to the gods of labor disputes, or they will be made up at a later non-scheduled time. You were in Southern California this past weekend at the Adrenaline High Rollers event. I was on field at the Weekend 2 Fall IL Recruiting Invitational all weekend. But the thing in the lacrosse world that is happening that everybody needs to know about, we're nearly done editing Face Off Yearbook.
Yeah, it's been a pretty uneventful off-season, quote-unquote off-season, right?
It has certainly been that, and as you know, the reason I wanted to have this podcast, this is going to be the first of a series of podcasts derivative of Face Off Yearbook content, but I wanted to have one to kind of set the tone, because the last couple things that we do are edit the coaches poll, the All-Americans, and then go through and kind of reread all of the team write-ups for, you know, the all 73 Division I teams. And it, when you do that, you can come away with a sense of the Division I men's lacrosse landscape that's probably a little bit better honed than it really is at any other point. And so I just had a few observations that I wanted to talk about, and I wanted to bounce them off you.
All right, let's do it.
All right, so the first thing that I came away from is this is a little bit of a reset year for college lacrosse, and it's primarily because we don't enter the year with a bona fide star, the likes of Miles Jones or Lyle Thompson, even Bren Reeves. Patrick Spencer, yes, certainly that. But when I went through the All-America list, I was stunned by how stacked this junior class is. This reset year is a breakout year for all these juniors who either have broken out, but not to the extent that they will, or haven't quite broken out yet. And I don't want to get ahead of myself, because the 2019 season has a lot in store, but the 2020 season is going to be pretty amazing because all these guys are going to be seniors.
Yeah, and I'm even thinking beyond that. When they're going to be drafted into professional leagues, I'm like, wow, this is going to be like that 1986 draft class in the NFL, featuring all these amazing quarterbacks that went on to have these tremendous NFL careers. But you're absolutely right. I remember going back 2 years ago when this freshman class, you know, these juniors were freshmen then and they were performing great. I actually was looking back through that article I wrote where I compared it to the class of 2009 that featured guys like Rob Pinnell, Mark Matthews, Steele Stanwyck, guys went on to have tremendous careers. And it's crazy to think that there's guys like Jeff Teaton's class who, you know, scored 99 points as a sophomore. And then, you know, Michael Krause, I think about it. It's such an attack-heavy group with Jerry Bernhardt, Michael Sowers, all those guys. It's going to be fun. And, it was really easy to go through and make that preseason All-Americans list, especially on the attack end, because you just think of those juniors. It's incredible.
But it's not just that, because there's also T.D. Erland, who I will argue is the most impactful player in college lacrosse. And then there are some studs at the defensive end as well. J.T. Giles Harris, probably chief among them.
Yeah, and he was one guy that I think is going to have a great year as a junior this season. I just feel like he'll probably take that mantle as the number one cover guy after he basically marked Ben Reeves in the national championship game, and I thought he did a pretty good job. So yeah, but I think you're right. T.D. Erland was actually, I think, the fifth ranked face-off guy in our top 100 that year. So that's on me. I'm pretty much the guy who headed that development. So I feel bad about that one.
Moving on, the next observation I had is that, and this won't come as a surprise, I don't think, but people are all over the place when it comes to North Carolina. Tabulating the coaches' votes, there were some guys who didn't have North Carolina in their top 25, and then there were other guys who had them 6th, 7th. It was pretty remarkable, the spread that people felt like the Tar Heels were going to fill this year.
Well, it feels like last year's season for the Tar Heels was a bit of an anomaly because they had so many guys who were injured. They had turnover at really important positions like goalie and faceoff. They also started the season, you know, 6-0, and then went on to lose 7 straight games, and then they finally came around to .500 with a, you know, a last game victory against Notre Dame. So it kind of just was this strange season in itself. After seeing the Tar Heels in the fall, I feel like the potential is there, and I think that's what some of the coaches who ranked them so high possibly thought as well. You know, they get their entire starting midfield back. All guys are going to be juniors. And they've got a lot of new talent at the attack position that could be, you know, coming around. But I think the defensive end is where they could make a lot of strides. You know, one big takeaway I had from the fall was that Will Bowen in that scrimmage against Ohio State was just an animal, causing turnovers, looking like a gazelle in the middle of the field. And it just looks like he'd been playing for years, and it was crazy to think that this kid was a freshman. And if they combine that with some steadiness and goal, I think there's real potential for the Tar Heels, especially in an ACC, you know, where Duke loses big guys like Gutterding. We're not exactly sold on Virginia with the way they play defense. I think there's opportunity there for the Tar Heels.
Who's going to score the goals that Chris Cloutier made out of nothing?
That's a good question.
And it's
I think
a question
that's their chief, you know, their number one kind of answer to find in this offseason is how do we replace such a steady shooting and scoring presence? I mean, you get him with a look, you get him with his left hand, you get him with his feet set. The money's there. The ball's going in the back of the net. You know, if anybody could fill that role, it could be Tanner Cook, because, you know, he's a guy who has a very similar skill set in that, you know, if you get him with his left hand and his feet set, that ball's going in the back of the net. But he plays midfield. Do you move him to attack? Lots of questions there as well.
Yeah, Tanner Cook was probably the breakout star of last fall. And not to say that, you know, I think he finished with right around 20 points. It's a good season for a sophomore midfielder, but didn't quite meet the level that I had set in terms of my expectations. And it's an interesting idea. I think that there are a number of teams that are facing the question of moving great offensive players from midfield to attack, and it dovetails nicely into the next point or observation that I have that I want to bounce off you, which is that I don't think that there's a bona fide favorite for midfielder of the year, and I think that that is different from prior years. I mentioned Miles Jones as being, you know, kind of a no-brainer candidate, and then, you know, you go back farther and consider years like Tom Schreiber and when he comes back and all that sort of stuff. But looking at this group of midfielders, I think Brad Smith is probably the senior with the most accomplished career to this point, where I would say that would be a really logical choice. And then Dax Aiken, between his production and his profile, would probably be the second candidate, but neither rises to the level of like a no-brainer, that guy's the favorite type of situation. And it's, you know, not... Essentially, I'll put it this way. There isn't an equivalent to Pat Spencer at the midfield in terms of the likely, you know, senior heading into the season who's going to be that guy. And one of the reasons that I would be loath to say that about Smith is because, in the same way that it probably makes sense for Tanner Cook to play attack, I wouldn't be stunned if Duke's extensive track record of moving middies to attack, Jack Bruckner being the most recent example, is extended with Brad Smith playing on that right wing.
No, I can absolutely see that happening. It's like almost as much of a tradition as giving the number 8 to your best finisher at Duke. So I can definitely see that happening. You can say so?
Well, the second part of this point about this midfield class is that while it might lack the clear star power at the top, it's deeper than usual. I remember there being years struggling to find 9 midfielders who felt like relatively pure midfielders or even two-way guys that made sense to fill out a preseason All-America ballot with. And this year, I went down to 14 before I even struggled. Lucas Wittenberg was, in my estimation, the 14th midfielder heading into the season. And in other years, I think he probably could have been a preseason second-team All-American.
Yeah, I agree with your similar point, where you even go back to last year when we all thought that Connor Kelly was going to be like the bona fide midfield star. It does kind of feel that way. I would, you know, include guys like at the top of my list. I know Max Tuttle, 46 goals last year as a midfielder, really impressive. And then you've got other guys like Brian Costabu, who you think could have a big year. Trey LeClaire's kind of been listed as a midfielder, even though he kind of plays a hybrid position.
Jack Ty.
McCullough
out of Cornell. A couple other Cornell midfielders as well kind of warrant that level of consideration.
Yeah.
Jamie Trimboli is one that I think folks ought to keep an eye on. Jeff Traynor at UMass had a really productive season last year. I mean, Colton Jackson was a guy that, remember when Kark said like 3 years ago, beat Denver now because you're not going to be able to beat him the next 2 or 3 years? And I think, you know, Colton Jackson was one of the guys that inspired that comment. Bubba Fairman is another guy who I think is a reasonable choice for a preseason All-America list.
Oh, yeah. I love this MIDI group, and I think the person I would peg to have the best year has to be Dox Aitken. And that's purely from a scoring perspective. I know last year Ryan Conrad goes down, and he really does become that alpha dog Virginia midfielder that we've seen in years past, scores 40-plus goals. And I know the coaching staff going into that season was like, this kid is going to be amazing. I felt like, given the expectations, he probably did match them. And I feel like going into this year, he really needs to take that next step and go and exceed those expectations.
Moving on, my next observation is that the media and coaches agree about Albany. Both see Albany as a mid-teens level program, somewhere in the 13, 14, 15 range.
Yeah, and I would think that is probably where they should be placed. I mean, the Dane train has to continue, but you do lose so many important guys. Connor Fields, TD Ireland transfers out. You lose a starting goalkeeper who has been a rock for them for a couple of years. And Albany's success, I think, going into 2019 really pegs on, I think, two developments on the offensive end, and that's Jacob Patterson probably moving to attack full-time and becoming the team's main initiator, and then Tohoka Nandikoke pretty much keeping at the level of production that he did last year or increasing it. And, of course, he's not with the team this fall. We don't really know what's going on there. So there is a lot of what-ifs going on with Albany right now.
For me, it's funny because I see there being, yes, there's no question that, Patterson and Nanakoke are essential to Albany's success. I think that this is going to be an Albany team that's reminiscent of some of those good pre-Lyle Thompson teams,
mm-hmm.
Because I think that there's more talent than a lot of people realize. And I remember after Brett Queener graduated and the Merrick Thompson and Joe Resiteret's group moved on, I still was like, man, I really like Joe Pompo. I really like Brian Caulfield. There are these players that are good players and keeping Albany very relevant in the America East. It kind of coincided with when UMBC was cresting in the post Brendan Mundorf and Andrew Westervelt era. And then, Stony Brook obviously went on a run with Kevin Crowley and Jordan McBride. But there are some guys, I really like Sean Eccles. I think that, he seems like the type of player who can kind of carry the mold or carry the mantle that Kyle McClancy set. Davis Diamond is a player who has made plays when he's gotten the opportunity, but, he's been a little bit buried on the depth chart because there was so much talent. Beyond that, this is a group that's going to be really good defensively, I think. They bring back a handful of starters. Eric DeLuy is one of the most fun players to watch in college lacrosse because he's pretty short, but he's really powerful and he knows how to keep guys from getting to his spots. Ron John is a defenseman that got a lot of playing time for being a fourth defenseman last year. I think that they're going to struggle to face off, which is something that that Albany is very familiar with. And the question in goal is a really fair one, but we've seen a lot of the guys that had been backing up come through inside lacrosse recruiting invitationals, committed academy, etc. And I think that there are some guys that are ready to answer the bell. So I guess my point is, you can kind of spin Albany's prognosis both directions. You can talk about all the losses for sure, and they're meaningful, but it does feel a little bit, I don't want to say piling on, but this team was going to be a very different team regardless of the circumstances surrounding Erlin or Nanakoke because of how good that senior class was. Some programs have graduated great senior classes, and they didn't lose that much because the guys behind them were nearly as good. You just didn't see them because they couldn't get on the field on game day.
Yeah, and going back, I think, 2 years ago to the day that Tohoka Nanakoke had that crazy goal at the Headstrong event at Boys Latin.
Oh, how quickly time passes. Dan, that was only 1 year
ago. Yeah, that was 1 year ago. Shoot. It feels like 2 years ago.
There you go.
But I remember watching Albany, I think, play Richmond, and they really got deep into their bench, and they started playing a lot of freshmen and younger guys. And I was like, wow, like, this Albany team, their bench is athletic. I feel like 2-3 years down the road, these guys are going to be playing in the middle of the field, and they're going to be good as just as good as guys like Kyle McClancy, but they're going to be super athletes. They're going to be able to play both ways super effectively. I feel like if there is one maybe saving grace for Albany, amidst all these losses, it's that they return possibly their best athletic group yet.
So it'll be fascinating to watch. And certainly I think it's going to be a different Albany group, particularly because, like I said, that talent at the defensive end, Connor Filipowski is another one that deserves mention. You know, he's taller, really strong, can cover with range. You know, I do think that they're going to be a group that's going to be able to put clamps on in ways that maybe folks aren't used to seeing out of Albany. Moving along. There is as much consensus that Gerard Arcari is the second best faceoff guy in college lacrosse as there is that T.D. Erlin is the first. And that surprised me. I didn't think that Gerard Arcari was that dominant relative to the dominance that Erlin showed. Does that surprise you, or is that something that kind of matches what your expectation was?
It doesn't necessarily surprise me, but it is surprising to see that, you know, the coaches and kind of the media have that consensus. You know, I think as a guy who, you know, follows lacrosse as closely as I do, you kind of know that, but to see these other people kind of validate my position is very interesting. And I do think that, you know, Gerard Arcari is the clear second best faceoff guy. You know, he's been starting as long as T.D. Erlin. I think he's just suffered from the exposure that we've been giving to not only T.D. Erlin in the past 2 years, but Trevor Baptiste and that kind of duopoly at the top of the faceoff bracket that we had last season.
No doubt. Well, not only that, but also, you know, the strength, particularly 2 years ago, of the faceoff position in the Big Ten, and you know what that meant relative to being able to get to the 70-75% level that Erlin did, you know, versus being at a very impressive 62% or 63%. Alex Woodall is the third team All-American. He's who you voted for. And the only other two guys that really warranted consideration on the basis of the media All-America voting were also Big Ten faceoff guys, Justin Shockey and Justin Anasio. I picked Shockey as my third team All-American. I don't understand why I'm struggling to ask this question. It's a very simple one. Do you think at the end of the year, how confident are you that this preseason prognostication is going to hold up?
I think it will hold up. The thing is, we had to choose three guys. So we basically went down the list and said, who are the three best guys, possibly with the best face-off winning percentage? And I think that's kind of how it played out for us. But also just knowing how much Alex Woodall and his ability to win draws is crucial to Towson's game. I think what you saw with, you know, both Shockey and Anasio was they were young guys kind of thrown into the fire pit early. You know, Shockey split draws with Austin Henningsen throughout the year. Justin Anasio was still coming off of an injury that he sustained in the Under Armour All-America game, and he really hit his stride late in the season. It'll be interesting to see if, at the end of the year, we had those same three guys. Who's in the honorable mention? Is it Justin Shockey? Is it Justin Anasio? Because those were the two guys where, like, man, if it weren't for these three guys, I would definitely be voting for them because we've seen what they can do at the high school level. They're outstanding. If they can replicate that same kind of success that they had in Division I, they're going to be monsters.
How do you foresee the shot clock affecting face-off guys?
I want to say that it won't affect too much, but if we do see games, you know, having higher scores, having more goal totals, what we'll see is maybe more splitting of face-offs and possibly, you know, thirding or having a face-off, essentially, where you have a second guy, which is something Maryland, like I said, did all of last year, and it actually played out pretty well. Both Henningsen and Shockey went at about 50% or more, and I think that's going to become kind of a trend because, you know, you not only worry about the face-off guys getting tired, you worry about the wear and tear of the overall season. We've seen a lot of face-off guys get hurt over the past couple of years.
I think that's a good comment. I also think that one of the value of losing a face-off, the damage of losing a face-off is lower.
Yeah,
when there's
absolutely
a shot clock. So does that make you more willing to throw your second or third guy out there than you might have been in prior years?
I think it does because, you know, with the shot clock, you know that there's going to be a lot more back and forth. There's going to be a lot more turnover, not necessarily, you know, goals and stuff. You know, they're going to go down, they're going to take a shot. It could be a violation. It could be a save, and you can get the ball back. So I feel like the value of the face-off and the value of winning an individual face-off goes down a bit with these new rules.
And it'll be interesting to see how that manifests itself in the stats as well, because when both teams are engaging in using more face-off guys, if that's what ends up happening, I also think that that will happen. And one of the other reasons that we haven't addressed is the number of faceoff specialists entering college lacrosse is greater than it has been because the quality of coaching, specialty coaching at high school, and the incredible job that the those groups led by Faceoff Academy have done to make kids want to be faceoff guys is increased. So everybody's a little bit more confident in their second and third faceoff guy than maybe they were 6 years ago. So it all manifests itself, in my estimation, in your top tier faceoff guys taking fewer draws. And look no further than Yale, where not only do they have the, you know, unanimous first team All-America selection, they also have the top ranked or tied for top ranked faceoff guy in the freshman class coming in Joe Newman. So you would expect that Erland's not going to take the nearly 400 faceoffs that he took last year.
No, I would not expect him to. Probably 300, but not 400.
It's an interesting consideration. It'll be one that we keep our eye on. Moving along, Dan, the coaches are very high on Johns Hopkins. What say you?
I would agree with them. I feel like, you know, looking at what they bring back, they lose some really important pieces. I think, you know, Hunter Moreland and Shaq Stanwyck being the chief among them.
And Joel Tinney.
And that was going to be the point I was going to get to later. You do have to replace 30-plus assists from Joel Tinney. And, you know, outside of Shaq Stanwyck, your top returning assister is Kyle Maher, who is...
A goal scorer.
Yeah, I was about to say, he is your shooter. He's the guy you want with the ball, with his feet set, with his left hand. And how do we work around that? You know, you got Joey Epstein coming in, very highly touted freshman, our number one guy. You can't expect him to come in and have the same impact that a Shaq Stanwyck does in his senior year. That's why I feel like a lot of Hopkins' success is going to depend on Cole Williams and his ability to kind of evolve his game as a feeder. You know, he had 35 goals last year, I think only 14 assists. But, you know, talking to a lot of guys who played defense against him last year, they said, this is the hardest cover I've ever had in my entire high school, entire lacrosse career, essentially. So if he can start parlaying that into, you know, feeds, finding open guys, carrying doubles, I think Hopkins could be very dangerous. And also, they bring back, I believe, their entire starting defense and a few LSMs.
Yeah, between, you know, Kuhn and Daniel Jones and, you know, down low, Patrick Foley is one of the best cover guys. They definitely have a core defensively, and I think that that's probably the reason the coaches feel good about them. And certainly, you know, they're coming off of an NCAA quarterfinal appearance. It's not as if it's a surprise, but, you know, they are situated in that 5-6-7 spot. It's probably appropriate, but I noticed it. You mentioned something that I want to use as a little bit of a quick aside. Kyle Maher as the lefty shooter, you know, it's a role that most teams have. I'll give you, and I'm going to keep thinking about who the other guys are, but I'm going to give you Maher, Mac O'Keefe, and Ethan Walker just to take 10 shots from the, you know, that 10 and 10 spot. Who are you going with? Who's your guy?
I'm going to go with Ethan Walker first, Mac O'Keefe second, Kyle Maher third.
That was what I said as well. When I was writing up a quick blurb about Denver, I said that Ethan Walker is probably the best left-handed shooter in college lacrosse. And it'll be interesting to see what impact Alex Simmons, presuming Alex Simmons ends up starting on the opposite side, what impact that has. Because when I saw Simmons for Culver play against McDonough last year, I was so impressed by his ability to dodge in so many different ways, and I just thought this is the perfect complement to Walker because he's going to create so much gravitational pull. He's going to bring defenders so close to him that he's going to create so much space on the opposite side of the field. It was really reminiscent is not the right word, but I imagined it being something like, I'm going to take a sidebar to the sidebar. One of my favorite offenses in the time I've covered, you know, I've worked in South Lacrosse, so dating back to the 2008 season, that I covered extensively was the 2010 Loyola squad. And the reason was because Mike Sawyer and Eric Lusby were complementary right-handed and left-handed shooters, each of which were able to shoot and hit from like 14 to 16 yards consistently. And they were able to do from really low angles, like below 7 yards above GLE. So in that kind of, you know, so if the goal line is the 10-yard line on the football field, they were shooting outside the hash marks, like somewhere around the 15-yard line. And it just created so much width that defenses had to cover that the guys up top, whether it was Sean O'Sullivan, a transfer from Army who was a really good step-down shooter, or Davis Butts, who was a really good right-handed alley dodger, there was so much more space. The slides, the hedges were so much longer than what defenses were used to. And then conversely, Justin Ward was able to both attack, kind of right along the crease from X, or he was able to kind of throw really accurate pinpoint feeds because, again, you know, these guys, these defenders had to stay so close to these shooters that there was a lot of room in passing lanes to throw, you know, good passes to cutters, lead them, because you weren't worried about a stick coming down, knocking the ball down. I can see Denver with, presuming again that Simmons is on that right side and Walker on the left side, having that same level of symmetry and lateral spacing that I think is really valuable for teams because of all the reasons I just laid out.
Yeah, and I can see that happening. I feel like Alex Simmons is going to dodge from the high wing, face dodge, draw a slide. There'll be a skip pass wide open to Ethan Walker for a score. I can see that happening all year long.
The last thing I want to talk about is, and I don't know if you saw, but Evan Malloy engaged with Travis Eldridge on Twitter about this yesterday. What happened to the goalie position? Particularly, what happened to the goalie position at the high major conferences? The ability to finish a season stopping better than 53% is almost non-existent at this point. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm probably not the guy to answer that. I've never played goalie in my life, even though I do come from a family of a lot of great goalies, but you know, in recent years, we've seen, you know, some of the best goalies emerge from, you know, not the powerhouse teams. You know, I think I voted for Nick Wachuta out of Vermont as my first team, you know, this, you know, going into the preseason this year. In the past years, we've had, you know, great goalies come out of Richmond. We've had great goalies come out of all these different places.
Albany, you mentioned J.D. Colarusso earlier in the podcast.
And you start to wonder,
And it's not just Wachuta at Vermont this year either. You know, the other guys that are getting attention are Alex Hager from Robert Morris, you know, Sean Scannone from UMass. Like, and it's not to say that we haven't seen great goalies come out of non-traditional or non-top 10, top 15 programs in the past. But I think that the difference this year is how few top 10 programs have goalies that are returning who have stopped better than 53% the prior year or even over the course of their career.
Yeah, and you start to wonder, is it because offenses in these conferences are too good? Is it a problem with the recruiting process that these teams are going through? I'm not sure if I have the answer there. It is very puzzling, though. And I look at some of the goalies coming this year. Like, I feel like, you know, Phil Goss is a guy who would have such a better percentage if he faced less shots. Like, I think he's taking on like 20 plus shots a game at some points.
Well, and that's where the, you know, question of the shot clock comes back. Is the shot clock going to create lower quality, easier saves, lower quality shots that yield easier saves? Or is it going to increase the number of shots taken and the number of goals scored? I don't know. It's going to have an effect on save percentages. I just haven't made a decision on which way I expect it to go.
I can actually see all three of those things coming true. You're going to see poor shots, you're going to see more shots, and you're going to see more goals. And I think that they can all increase in their own way.
So do you think that a guy like let's think of the right Alex Rode, who was probably like pushing 55% last year, you think that he could get back to 60 because of the shot clock this year?
Possibly.
It'll be interesting to follow. Dan, I'm going to turn it back around on you. Were there any observations that you took away when you were reading Face Off Yearbook that you would like to bounce off of me and get my reaction to?
Yeah, one thing that I was thinking about after just kind of doing all the research and just reading all the stuff that we had written was, it feels like this year that there isn't really a preseason like team that we peg as like, this team is clearly the national championship favorite. I feel like, you know, going into this year, we have Yale, they have T.D. Yearlin, but they lose Ben Reeves. And you say, like, can they win it without Ben Reeves? He feels like a generational talent. I feel like in past years, we've had a clear, like, oh, this is the best team. If they don't win the national championship, shame on them.
I totally agree. I think the reason is because of the top eight teams, six of them lost their best player. You mentioned Yale losing Reeves. Maryland loses Connor Kelly. Duke graduates Justin Gutterding. It's only Loyola bringing back Patrick Spencer and Cornell bringing back Jeff Teat that kind of break that mold, so to speak. And, you know, I think what that manifests is a discomfort with who's this team going to be without their alpha male.
Yeah.
And so just the relatively few number of teams who you feel confident about what their identity is going to be, and the fact that Loyola lost in the quarterfinals. Loyola has a national championship pedigree. Cornell is only 2 years removed from being like not really even competitive in the Ivy League. It's hard to imagine them being a bona fide national championship contender that quickly. And so if you remove those two teams from the equation, then you start to ask yourself, you know, particularly obviously we've talked about all the Final Four teams and, you know, some of the other quarterfinal losers and, you know, the fact that so many of them have graduated, if not necessarily their best player, then the guy who was kind of the quarterback of their offense, like Shaq Stanwyck. I think that's what the source of like a clear favorite is. I think I tweeted this at one point. I did. I remember sending it out. You know, so one of my roles is I create this like little, I don't know what you would call it, like it's a spreadsheet that has columns for all the players that are graduated, all the seniors that are coming back, all the non-senior returners that matter, and all the incomers that we think might make an impact. And, you know, there's a couple other kind of points of data, wins, losses, RPI, efficiency rating. And my comment at the time was, dating back to doing this since 2009, I've never struggled as much to pick the number one team heading into the season. I don't think that it's a coincidence. And I think that if Ben Reeves had been a junior last year, that wouldn't have been very difficult.
No, that kind of a sidebar there as well, but I feel like, you know, looking at the guys I voted for in my All-America team, there was a lot of guys who either their team didn't make the playoffs last year or they, you know, didn't go far in the NCAA tournament. It could be a very interesting year where we see a lot of these teams that have been kind of on the outside looking in finally break through.
And that's taking us all the way back to where we started, which is this is kind of a reset year. And in reset years, Face Off Yearbook is twice as valuable as it is in non-reset years. So I've got to make sure that all of you head to the Inside Lacrosse shop in order to find it. Pre-orders are on sale now. We promise a great product, as always. And we appreciate you listening. We will be back in the coming days with additional podcasts. We're going to talk about D3. We're going to talk about recruiting, as always. And we're going to bring in some interviews. So, Dan, I appreciate you joining me on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Follow him.
@Dan_Aburn.
I am @Terrence Foy. If you like what you heard, please leave a rating, tell a friend, and we will talk to you again soon.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.